This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security issued a report warning of dangerous overcrowding in migrant detention facilities in the border state of Texas. The report came a day after a group of U.S. lawmakers, all Democrats, toured detention centers and denounced the conditions there as, in their words, horrifying, and border officers' behavior as unconscionable. The AP's Sagar Magani reports.
When congressional Hispanic caucus members visited facilities in Joaquin Castro's home state of Texas yesterday, officials asked them to leave their cell phones behind. Castro kept his.
They said that they changed her medicine.
And released footage from an El Paso facility, saying he wants the public to see the awful conditions, with women crammed into prison-like cells.
There was no running water for people to drink. In fact, one of the women said that she was told by an agent to drink water out of the toilet.
Castro says he hopes Congress will impose standards of care at the facilities along with broader immigration reform. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The remaining signatories to the 2015 International Pact to Restrain Iran's Nuclear Weapons Development are expressing concern that Tehran had exceeded the limit on how much low-enriched uranium it could stockpile. Britain, France, Germany, and the European Union said in a joint statement they have been consistent and clear that their commitment to the nuclear deal depends on full compliance by Iran, and urged the Islamic Republic to refrain from further use and undermine the accord. President Trump withdrew the United States from the Iran nuclear deal last year, saying it did not have enough to prevent Tehran from developing nuclear weapons. Iran's Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, argued the breaching of the stockpile limit did not violate the accord because the deal was a provision. At one party responded, out of the deal, leaves the agreement open. This is VOA News. President Trump may have jump-started a new round of working-level talks with Pyongyang at his meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, but their handshake is meaningless, unless negotiators make progress on bridging the country's divergent approaches toward denuclearization. Most recent talks stalled at the Hanoi summit in February, and a process expert said the upcoming working-level talks to get Washington and Pyongyang to bridge their differences on denuclearization will be difficult but not impossible. Pyongyang favors taking a phased approach with each step taken toward denuclearization, rewarded with some corresponding measure. Washington has been interested in drawing up a comprehensive denuclearization deal that includes the dismantlement of Pyongyang's entire nuclear program. A U.S. military jury in San Diego found a decorated U.S. Navy SEAL not guilty of murdering a captive teenager Islamic State militant in Iraq in 2017. Edward Gallagher was also acquitted of two counts of attempted murder, but was found guilty of posing with the corpse of a prisoner. Gallagher's lawyer said, "This is a big win."
Suffice to say, huge victory, huge weight off the Gallaghers.
The sole guilty verdict carries a 4-month sentence, but Gallagher spent 9 months in pretrial detention, meaning he will go free. The United States designated a major anti-Pakistan militant organization conducting deadly attacks against local and foreign targets in the South Asian nation as a global terrorist. Islamabad promptly welcomed the move, which prohibits U.S. citizens from engaging in any transactions with members of the so-called Balochistan Liberation Army, the BLA, and all of their property in the U.S. are blocked. The outlawed BLA is considered the largest and most effective of several Baloch militant groups fighting the Pakistani rule in the province. And a Philippine man has been identified as one of two people who carried out a suicide bombing attack on a military outpost in the southern island of Jolo last week. 5 people were killed in that attack. And the U.S. dairy industry hoping that coffee bars and high schools can help offset the persistent decline in U.S. milk consumption. The Trump administration, meantime, is giving up plans to include a citizenship question on the 2020 census. This means the U.S. Census Bureau can now start printing forms to be sent to more than 100 million American homes after Trump himself questioned whether the once-every-decade population count could be delayed. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbote in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 3rd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's opposition coalitions call for a new nationwide protest and civil disobedience.
Demonstrations in the street have really completely convinced them that they have to negotiate seriously with the opposition.
Togo's government launches a high council for the diaspora, while a diaspora spokesperson is not impressed. Free slaves continue to face barriers in Mauritania. A new study identified 100 million hectares of lost tropical rainforest for restoration. And Rwanda says it is ready to join forces with the DRC government to fight rebels operating inside DRC.
This problem has been there for too long. And if it affects the Congo, it affects the neighbors. So there's no point in allowing that problem to stand in the way of the progress we should be making.
That's President Paul Kagame of Rwanda, and an American student builds schools in Senegal. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's opposition coalition has called for a new nationwide mass protest and civil disobedience following Sunday's deadly protests. The opposition says the Sudan Transitional Military Council should be held responsible for the death of 10 protesters allegedly killed by security forces. The opposition denies the assertion and says it is not ready to hold any direct talks with the military council. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The Sudanese opposition says the protests are aimed at pressuring the Transitional Military Council to hand power to civilians. Opposition representatives are calling on citizens to hold mass protests for the next 2 weeks, day and night, to be followed by civil disobedience on July 14th. The Sudanese Medical Council says at least 7 protesters were killed last Sunday by Sudanese security forces, including one in Atbara of River Nile State. 3 dead bodies were also found Monday morning near Abuanja Bridge in Omdurman neighborhood. The Medical Council also says at least 181 people were injured on Sunday's protests. The Sudanese Transitional Military Council blames the opposition for the deaths and says calls for more protests amounts to inciting violence. General Kamaluddin Omar, the head of security and defense in the Transitional Military Council, told reporters on Sunday night that the Freedom and Change Coalition should be held responsible for the deaths and injuries that occurred on Sunday, including those of 3 members of Sudan Rapid Support Forces who were heard in Omdurman. Speaking in Arabic, he says security forces arrested 3 protesters. Omar says the Freedom and Change Coalition should take full responsibility for the lives lost both among organized forces and the citizens. Osman Hamid, the head of the Operations for Rapid Support Forces, admitted to reporters on Sunday that security used tear gas to dispatch the protesters after they tried to march towards the presidential palace. Hamid says the protesters were moving towards homes of martyrs, but after a while, they decided to march towards the presidential palace, and therefore security forces used tear gas to dispatch them. A spokesman for the Sudanese Professionals Association, a member of the Freedom and Change Coalition, condemned the use of force against the peaceful protesters and called for an investigation into the incident. Speaking to Al Hadas TV channel in Sudan, Ismail Taj says members of the Sudanese Professionals Association plan to visit family members of people who were killed during Sunday's protests, but says that depends on the situation on the ground. Taj says the association did not identify a fixed route for the protest and the group was ready for any possibility that might occur. Haj Hamad, a political science lecturer at Khartoum University, says the protest is a clear message to both the Transitional Military Council and the opposition that the revolution still belongs to the Sudanese people. Hamid says Sunday's protest is a clear indication that many Sudanese are still demanding civilian rule.
Demonstrations in the street have really completely convinced them that they have to negotiate seriously with the opposition.
Hamid believes the mass protests will force the military council and the opposition to return to the negotiation table and reach to a compromise soon. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
The Rwandan government says it is ready to join forces with the Democratic Republic of Congo's army to fight rebel groups operating inside DRC forests. But different Rwandan dissidents say this is part of President Paul Kagame's trick to exploit the vast mineral resources of the DRC. Yuji Wimana has more from Kigali.
President Paul Kagame made the declaration Tuesday while addressing journalists in Kigali ahead of Rwanda Liberation Day, which is tomorrow, 4th July. Hearing efforts of the DRC's President Felix Tshisekedi to fight rebel groups, Kagame said what Rwanda has achieved in the last 25 years deserves high protection.
We've been waiting. I am glad that we have a person there saying he wants to work with the neighbors to get rid of this problem, because this problem has been there for too long. And it affects the Congo, it affects the neighbors, it affects all of us. So there is no point in sitting with that problem or allowing that problem to stand in the way of the progress we should be making.
In years past, Rwanda has tried to fight the FDLR rebel group, which the government says is composed of genocide perpetrators, but it didn't win the battle. The group is still active in the forests of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dissident groups say Mr. Kagame's real aim is to exploit DRC's vast mineral resources. Paul Rusesabagina is the vice president of the MRCD, Rwandan Movement for Democratic Change Party. This is not the first time that Rwanda will be sending soldiers in DRC in the name of securing the region. He should have said openly that he wants DRC's gold, diamond, and other natural resources. All that he wants is the gateway. Rwanda believes the DRC is home to hundreds of alleged Rwanda genocide perpetrators who fled the country in 1994. The United Nations says many rebels are hampering the response to the Ebola outbreak in the DRC. The World Health Organization says there have been 130 attacks on health facilities between January and May 2019, resulting in 4 deaths and injuring 38, as well as risking a further spread of the Ebola virus. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The Togolese government has launched what it calls the High Council for the Togolese Diaspora. Foreign Minister Robert Dorsey said the council will serve as a vehicle for the exchange of ideas between the government and the diaspora. The government has also announced visa exemption for Togolese with dual citizenship. Claudine Mante, a member of the civil society group Togo Debut or Togo Stand Up, says the diaspora was never consulted about the new council. She says the first thing that President Faure Gnassingbé Bo's government should do is to establish good relations with the Togolese people at home, who she says have been repressed under the more than 50 years that Mr. Gnassingbé and his late father have ruled Togo.
As far as we were concerned, I reached out to responsible of movement and key resource person here in the United States. None of them was aware of that until we found it out on the news yesterday and today. So to answer your question, we wasn't consulted about this.
According to the foreign minister, the council will represent the Togolese diaspora, and it will serve mainly as a place for exchange of ideas between the diaspora and the government.
It doesn't make any sense. What connection with the government? When in the first place, everybody know that a lot of Togolese abroad left that dictatorship regime country because of the oppression, because of people get killed, their lives are in danger. That's one of the first reasons why we left, for better opportunity abroad. So for them to come out and say they're trying to have, what kind of connection are they trying to have? They first need to start having those connections with people living within Togo.
The government said that the goal of the council will be to mobilize the diaspora to deal with the obstacles to development in Togo.
We know that government be trying to stay in power. They will do everything to look good from the outside. That government, they don't care about our people back home. And one of the reasons why, again, we left Togo is because we need better opportunity. We were oppressed in our own country.
Perhaps the government of President Ford Nasibwe is ready to now reach out to you all. And the council that the foreign minister proposes, one thing it will do is that it will set up a whole week to celebrate the successes of the diaspora. They are offering visa exemption for Togolese with dual citizenship.
Why will he reach out to us in the first place when, you know, not too long ago, we got our lives are in danger? When I was trying to go back last year for the forum with Togo Dubu, I was told that my safety is not guaranteed. And I received a lot of death threats. Some people telling me, hey, once you get in there, we don't care if you have U.S. citizen or not. You're going to go to jail for at least 3 months. We're going to show you how it works here. You need to shut your mouth. You need to stop talking about us. You need to stop disgracing your country. Those are the same people trying to offer us something. To be honest, I really don't believe. They're trying to reach out to the diaspora because they know that we in the diaspora, we send a lot of money back home. We help out our family. They know our power. They know that we have the voice. We have power. We can speak our mind without worrying about repression. And they're trying to sugarcoat for Nyasimbe. He's been president for more than 3rd term. He's trying to seek a 4th term next year. He just needs to stop and let somebody else come in.
Claudine Mantic, a member of the civil society group Togo Debut or Togo Stand Up. She was speaking with me from the Midwestern region of the United States. Today is Wednesday, July 3rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. In 1981, Mauritania became the world's last country to abolish slavery, but the practice remains prevalent, and the government is doing little to combat it. Even though independent organizations are helping free slaves throughout the country, victims still face hurdles in their new lives. Elsha Saraya reports from Nuacha.
Barka Mintyarba doesn't know how old she is. 8 years ago, Barka moved with her family to the capital of Nouakchott from the city of Atar, where she was born into slavery. Though she has been freed, she has no official papers and no ability to acquire documentation required to attend school or work in most jobs. For the past 8 years, Barka has been a housekeeper and a cook for a family. Barka says the work isn't too tiring and that she is happy with her life, but she still lacks identity papers, preventing her from seeking other work or pursuing her education, an education she missed as a child. Barka says she spent long childhood days watching after her master's flock. Barka is one of an unknown number of Haratin in Mauritania born into slavery. Technically made illegal in the country in the 1980s, modern slavery remains a pressing problem, though the Sahara Desert country's government denies that. Many organizations in Mauritania work with limited funds to free slaves. Among them is SOS Esclave, which is dealing with 30 open cases. Barka's mother, Oul Moulkhair, is one of SOS's clients whose case remains open 8 years after she was legally freed. Oul Moulkhair says she is still waiting for reparations and for justice for all the damage her family suffered at the hands of slave owners, who left them without education or identification papers. Besides a lack of political will to fight or acknowledge the problem, NGOs and foreign governments have accused the Mauritanian government of denying entry and access to those pursuing information on modern slavery, as well as harassing and jailing anti-slavery activists in the country. Biram Da Abeid, who recently ran for president of Mauritania and has officially contested the results of the election, is one such anti-slavery activist who was previously jailed for 4 years. Abeid says that he has endured all kinds of torture and barriers to supporting his people, and that even for free slaves, systematic problems of education and housing remain. And education is a big concern for Mbarka, who recounts watching her master's children go to school and study the Quran while she did not and does not anticipate having any such opportunities. Still, Mbarka is hopeful about her future, confident that her life and the state of slavery in the country can only improve. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Nouakchott.
Researchers have identified more than 100 million hectares of lost lowland tropical rainforest restoration hotspots that present compelling opportunities for restoration to overcome rising global temperatures, water pollution shortages, and the extinction of plant and animal life. The findings are in a new study released today, Wednesday, by forest and environmental experts across the globe. Robin Chasden, one of the report's authors, tells Ricky Schreier that most of the hotspots for restoration are in Africa.
Those countries were Rwanda, Uganda, Burundi, Togo, South Sudan, and also Madagascar. So what that suggests is that these countries have, in their rainforest areas, that we only looked at tropical rainforest areas, so that's important to note. Within those areas, if forests are restored, they are likely to perform very well in a whole variety of ways, in terms of increasing water security, for also storing carbon, for protecting at-risk biodiversity, and for providing opportunities for migration for animals to suitable habitats.
When you guys say reforestation, what does that entail?
Our perspective is one of what we call forest and landscape restoration. So it's not just a question of wall-to-wall tree planting everywhere. This would involve a careful look at where different kinds of reforestation interventions would be most appropriate for the given context. For example, they could involve agroforestry, which includes cropping systems along with trees. They could involve restoring riparian alongside rivers to stabilize the banks and to improve water quality. They could involve tree planting on hillsides to reduce erosion and to protect watersheds. And they could involve some woodlots or some small-scale commercial uses for firewood or other kinds of local uses. So we're thinking about this. Oh, and finally, they could also involve natural regeneration, which is just in conditions where there is forest nearby, just allowing the forest to regrow. And that will be probably the best option for protecting biodiversity.
The African countries, for example, that you guys highlighted are very different and have very different levels of functioning governments or governments that have resources, I guess. Is it quite expensive to reforest? If it is expensive, and what kind of organizations are looking at helping these governments or working with these governments to get the resources together to do that?
Restoration can be very expensive, especially if you're planting nursery-grown seedlings and you have to develop those nurseries for native tree species. Less costly are things where you're integrating trees with cropping systems. And natural regeneration is probably the least expensive because you're using nature's own abilities to do the tree planting for the most part. Although sometimes fences need to be put up, there needs to be some fire protection in some cases. So the costs vary quite a bit depending on what the intervention is. And indeed, this is why those decisions really need to be made from local agencies.
Robin Charleston is one of the authors of a new report on reforestation hotspots. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Colorado in the United States. For more than a decade, students from a high school in San Francisco have traveled to Senegal to help villages improve their infrastructure. The partnership has resulted in the construction of several schools that have improved access to education for thousands of students. This year, the students helped build a school and a well in a community near Umbor. Anika Hamishla reports.
The roar of power drills fills the air in the village of Gidmakta, a typically quiet community of 2,000 people located some 100 kilometers from the Senegalese capital of Dakar. It's an unusual sound to behold in a village with no electricity, but the noise is a welcome disruption. A group of 13 students and 5 chaperones from Lick Wilmerding High School in San Francisco have spent the last 2 weeks building a primary school that will serve Gidmakta and its neighboring villages. They brought with them a variety of construction materials, including portable batteries for the power tools. Jacques Cousin is the group's coordinator and a retired school administrator. He's been organizing service trips to Senegal since 2006 and has facilitated the construction of 3 schools, a health clinic, and other development projects such as adding bathrooms and gardens to existing schools.
When you visit these schools and villages, you see how eager the kids are at learning anything, really.
Cousin said the projects also have provided jobs. Each school employs 4 or 5 teachers, plus a principal whose salaries are funded by the government.
They are a source of capital for the village, because those villages have very little opportunities for a cash economy.
Cousin's friends from San Francisco provide funding for construction costs, and the student volunteers pay for their own travel and accommodation expenses. Mustafa Nyan is a school inspector for Senegal's Ministry of Education. He said the schools Cousin has worked on have had a major impact on quality and access to education. The number of students passing their end-of-year exams has risen dramatically. He says all the conditions are met so that students can succeed. It's allowed students who maybe didn't have the chance or who had to travel great distances to go to school. And that's really something. In Guinmartin, many children don't receive a primary education because the nearest public school is 2 kilometers away. Sitor Diouf is the village chief. He says when a young child wants to start school, he can't because he's not able to walk this distance. Sometimes the sun is hot and he is not able to make the trip. So he may wait until he's older to walk this distance in order to go to school. Jeff said that even the nearest private school is 1.5 kilometers away, which is still too far for young children to walk. And the families who used to be able to pay tuition can no longer afford to do so because of a years-long drought. Jeff said when the villagers heard they would be receiving a new public school, everyone applauded.
C'est une joie énorme parce que c'était un souhait.
He says it's a huge joy because it's something they've wished for and needed for a long time that they were never able to have. A school in a village, it's not for 2 days, it's not for 3 days, it's for eternity. So really, they're very happy that these American students who came to work on the school, building the tables and benches, doing the painting, really, it's huge. The experience has been positive for the American students as well. Teresa Topete is a rising junior at Lake Wilmerding. In addition to building the school, she's been helping Cousin's wife, who's a gynecologist, provide basic health care to the villagers.
Just their, ability to stay like happier, really joyous and community-oriented through all of their struggles has been really eye-opening. I think just learning how to like move forward, and they're so appreciative of the like minimal resources they do have, has kind of helped me realize like how much we do take for granted.
The projects also provide employment to local masons who Cousin hires to construct the foundation, walls, and roofs of the buildings. The students are tasked with designing the blueprint for the school and painting and building desks and benches. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. At least 40 male African migrants were killed and 80 wounded in an airstrike on a migrant detention center near Tripoli late Tuesday, according to news reports. A Libyan Interior Undersecretary said the death toll is much higher, but that the rescue and recovery is ongoing. About 200 people were inside the center in the Tajura district outside the capital. Fighting for control of Tripoli between Libya's internationally recognized government and the Libyan National Army of a rival government led by General Khalifa Haftar has been raging for months in the Tripoli suburbs, with little progress made. The Libyan news agency denies responsibility for Tuesday's airstrike, blaming what it calls pro-government militias. And the Rwandan government said it is ready to join forces with the Democratic Republic of Congo's army to fight rebel groups operating inside DRC's forests. That is it for this Wednesday, July 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.